Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 15, Online Bullying and the Laws Against DDoS.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at typicalmacuser.com/WordPress and Immigration Tales at immigrationtales.com.
Hi, and welcome back to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host, and I'm here today with a super panel of folks to talk about more legal issues than we can shake many a stick at. So much has been going on lately. I'm really excited to have as a new guest on This Week in Law, Brian Cuban of the Dallas Mavericks. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here, Denise.
It's great to have you. Also back are some of our regulars, Colette Vogel of Colette Vogel's blog at the Internet Center for Internet and Society at Stanford, and also of Vogel Law. Colette, great to have you back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Ernie, better known as Ernie the Attorney online at ErnieTheAttorney.net. Also wonderful to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here.
And Marty Schwimmer of the Trademark Blog. And the Trademark Blog just celebrated, what, its sixth anniversary, I believe. So
absolutely.
Happy anniversary to you and your blog, Marty, and welcome back.
Thank you, Denise.
Brian Cuban, I should also mention, is a longtime blogger. Brian, what is the name of your blog one more time?
The Cuban Revolution.
The Cuban Revolution, that's right. And you've been blogging probably even before your brother Mark was. Is that right?
Probably around the same number of years.
Around the same time?
Yeah. We just, we tend to stray to different areas, but probably been doing it around the same time.
That's great. Did one or the other of you urge each other into it, or did you both kind of stumble into it independently?
Not just independently. If anything, Mark probably hates half the things I write. He disagrees with all of it.
You guys ever comment on each other's blogs?
Yes. But Mark really... Mark doesn't really, he won't comment on the blog. I'll get an email.
Yes, taking it offline.
That's right.
And so you are basically general counsel for the Mavericks?
I'm basically counsel for Mark Cuban Company.
Okay.
Which encompasses a number of different organizations. Primarily right now it's the Mark Cuban Foundation is what I do most of my work for Mark on.
Oh, that's great.
That's a nonprofit charity. Basically, it runs a charity called the Fallen Patriot Fund that provides grants to soldiers who were killed or injured in Iraq and who are unable to financially support themselves due to their injuries.
That's really neat. What is your background? You were in private practice before working for your brother's company. Is that right?
Yes, I did primarily employment law, non-competition, trade secret, and such. And then I've also done a lot of sports and entertainment law.
Yeah, I was laughing as I was looking through links to blogs and blogs prior for you that it seems as though you are buddies with someone I was once a summer associate with. Very small world. Angel Reyes.
Yes. Angel and I go back many years here in Dallas, not just as colleagues, but as friends.
He was one of the good-natured troublemakers of our summer class, I would say.
Yes. Angel is quite the character, and he has quite a name for himself as a plaintiff's lawyer here in Dallas.
Well, that's great. Well, the topics I wanted to cover today largely revolve around the subject of copyright and things that are going along there these days, and also cybercrime and cyberbullying. So why don't we start, Brian, with something that you posted on recently on the Cuban Revolution, which has to do with the Meghan Meyer case, and Lori Drew, I guess, the defendant now in a federal criminal indictment that is pending against her here in California, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes. As most people know, that Meghan Maher, a young girl on MySpace, was essentially being bullied by someone she thought was a high school peer of hers, and it turns out that it was this Lori Drew posing as a high school peer, and basically harassing her mercilessly. And the end result was, and again, it's in major, I think there's a lot of gray area about how much of a factor this actually played, but tragically, Meghan committed suicide. And there was all kinds of outrage. Everyone, when it came out that this lady, Lori Drew, was in fact the person behind all this bullying and all the, Meghan's actual suicide note was posted on MySpace, and it's you can see it on my blog. But there was all kinds of outrage over this, and the local police, I believe it was in Missouri, if I'm not mistaken, decided there was no crime had been committed. As I call it in my blog, all of a sudden, you have all this outrage, and we get what I call an outrage indictment. And I'm very critical of federal prosecutors of these things. Basically an indictment not based on any rule of law, but simply responding to the outrage in the community. And so they basically take a cyber statute that was designed for people hacking into other people's systems to obtain data and steal money, blah, blah, blah. And
right. It's called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yes. And they use the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to turn Lori Drew into this high-tech cyber criminal. Okay, point made. She did a bad thing. But, you basically have these federal prosecutors legislating from the courtroom, and that really bothers me. Did she do a bad thing? Sure. A lot of people certainly wish bad things on Lori Drew. But this is not what the statute was intended for. This is not the right way to use our laws. And I just have a real problem with it.
Yeah, it seems as though the statute is, among the many things that it criminalizes, is unauthorized access to computer systems for the purpose of gaining information. And the way that these prosecutors have crafted their complaint, the unauthorized access was had because Lori Drew used a false name when she signed up for her MySpace account. And that's
totally, just totally ridiculous. They're going to try to criminalize every person who signs up with a false, social networking account, no matter what their intent was. It's just ludicrous. You hear the old, these federal prosecutors watch too much Law and Order. You hear the old, the old phrase, you can indict a ham sandwich. Well, they got their ham sandwich and more here, and that's really all it is. It's a ham sandwich with nothing in it. This is not going to go anywhere. All they've done is cause more grief to a lot of people, where some closure is needed. If they want to do something, you write your congressman and amend and get some federal laws enacted to address cyberbullying, on a certain level, but not like this.
I have a question. This is Marty. I have no knowledge of criminal law in my state or the state where this took place. If Lori Drew had written the exact same things under pseudonymous letters that she left at Meghan's window, what would the civil and criminal analysis be of this act?
I don't think there's. I'm trying to figure out if you take away the statute. I can't figure out what she's done. What they've done, you got to separate the two issues. One, there's no causation here. Period. Okay, it is so tenuous and that's why they couldn't charge under any regular criminal statute you would expect them to look at. So they have to dig to find the cyber statute, and they come up with a tenuous connection to the cyber statute. But if you take away the cyber statute, what crime has she committed? What has she done? Even, maybe intentional infliction of emotional distress, maybe, depending on what the standard in your state is.
Right. And is that a crime? I mean, I think that's usually
not a crime.
A civil.
That's right. That's a civil tort. I mean, what is she, other than being a bad person, which in itself isn't a crime, I don't see what Lori Drew has done, that warrants this kind of just legal lynch mob, to go after her.
Right.
And that's all this is. This is a lynch mob.
I haven't looked at her postings in detail, but my general understanding of it is there were no threats made against Meghan Maher. Unfortunately, whatever was posted made her feel not great about herself, but there was nothing that, as far as I saw, rose to the level of a criminal harassment where somebody felt that their life or safety was in jeopardy.
I agree, and you know, I'll take a lot of grief for this, but it is really undisputed that Meghan Meyer had a lot of issues. Okay, you know, are we going to an eggshell skull here? You know, because this was just the final straw. We have criminal liability. You know, I mean, Meghan Meyer as a teen had a lot of issues. You know, and I just, you know, it is just such a stretch to say this one thing, you know, is the entire reason why the weight of the federal government should be coming down on Lori Drew.
Ernie, you want to?
Can I take the opposing view?
Of course.
And the reason, and I guess the reason I do this is whenever I was inclined when I read your post and went back and read the New Yorker article and read, you know, all the background, because I was vaguely aware of that case, and I can't claim to know a whole lot about it now, but I've read enough to become more familiar with it. And the more I read about it, the more I posed to myself the following question. Isn't prosecutorial reluctance or recalcitrance in some cases as bad as prosecutorial overzealousness? And by that, I mean there are cases where, and I'm not going to suggest that this is that case, but I don't think we really know exactly what happened. But my concern is, from reading the facts, at least in the New Yorker article, it looked like everybody knew that Lori Drew had done something bad, or people knew it, because she had been working in concert with other people to manipulate Meghan to get information to see if she was saying bad things about her daughter. Supposedly that was her justification. But in fact, instead of just asking questions, she pretends to be this person who really cares for Meghan and leads her on. It's a terrible thing that she did. Now, you know, whether it's a crime or not, nobody knows. But in the New Yorker article, they said that the police were aware of this problem and told Lori Drew that they didn't think it was a crime and just keep quiet about it. So at that point, it seems kind of strange to me, if that's true, that the police would take the view that, well, we're just not going to prosecute this. Why? I don't know, because it's a novel theory. I don't think that you shouldn't prosecute because it's a novel theory. Now, at this point, we're talking about the Missouri Police Department, not the federal prosecutors. I'm not sure that there should be a federal case. I think it should be a state case. But apparently the state folks thought something was wrong, but they didn't think that they had a basis to pursue a claim. So I guess my question is, what's wrong with pursuing a novel legal theory in the criminal realm? They do it in the civil cases all the time. We manipulate laws all over the place. People sue tobacco companies and say, well, let's add a couple of local defendants to keep it out of federal court, even though we have no real basis, or we don't even really care if we go after the local defendants. We just want to do that to manipulate the law. That happens all the time. So why shouldn't prosecutors take a novel legal theory if something really has been done that's wrong, and if there really is culpable conduct? We're not talking about the Duke prosecutor where he didn't know that what the facts were. If the facts are that Lori Drew really did these despicable things, then maybe the place for this to have been aired out would have been in a proceeding brought by the Missouri state authorities, rather than all of this publicity and then ultimately getting tossed over to the feds because the local guys didn't want to prosecute it. So that's my question.
That's a very valid point, and here's my response. Novel theories are great in the civil realm, okay, where, you know, money's at stake. I have a little bit more of a problem with novel theories based on criminal statutes where it's clear that intent was not that is not the intent of the statute in the criminal realm when people's lives and freedom are at stake. I just really it always just causes a knot in my stomach when we work backwards from the conduct. Okay, you know, we have this heinous conduct and therefore we are going to search high and low, no matter what. You know, no matter what theory we have to concoct to put this lady behind bars. I just don't like working backwards from the conduct to come up with the theory. You know, if there was something in the intent of the statute, in the case law interpretation of the statute, that gave any indication that this was something that was foreseen when the statute was drafted or would be in that realm, I'd say that's fine. But if you look at the statute, and I've read the statute, it's just not there. You know, and novel theories are great if you have a legitimate context and framework, but I just don't see that here.
Yeah, I have a problem with a statute being interpreted so broadly that it gives the federal government and its prosecutors the leeway to say, well, perhaps a lot of, you know, fairly benign activity will now technically fall within this statute. But we'd never prosecute that. We're only going to go after the really despicable activity.
And that's correct, Denise. And what they're basically doing is give themselves carte blanche to make and to come up with any interpretation they deem that suits their best interest. You know, and that's not the way it works. Or that's not the way it's supposed to work.
Denise, can I jump in? This is Colette.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to one of Marty's question about, you know, if this was done in the tangible world offline, you know, would this have been a crime? And I was reading Eric Goldman's blog post about this. He blogs through ericgoldman.org, and he pointed out that the kind of manipulation that was happening or possibly happening in this case between Drew and Meyer is similar to things like the dangerous liaisons situation. You know, for centuries, people have been playing games, so to speak. I know this is much more serious. And I thought that was an interesting example to point to because it's not, I don't think it's new that people are doing, are having these kinds of communications and manipulations, especially, you know, when it has to do with an individual's, how they feel about themselves and perhaps somebody who's very, impressionable or at an age in this case where, you know, how your peers feel about you matters a tremendous amount. You know, all of us in our, I don't know how old we all are, but for me in my mid 30s, you know, I feel like, oh, someone like this wouldn't be able to, you know, manipulate me in that way. And I should be tougher, but I think we need to remember the context of a young person and how they get impacted by these things. So I don't know if that, I mean, that certainly doesn't answer the question about whether there's a criminal law here to pursue, but I don't think it's anything new that these things are happening. And it's just the fact that it's now on MySpace and should it be different? The thing that interests me about this whole case is what it causes us to do with terms of service agreements that are on almost every reputable website these days. And are we shoehorning or pulling a lot more out of these terms of service agreements than they were ever intended to do? And I think that's an important issue that's going to, you know, if the terms of service that a company has crafted really just to defend themselves or protect themselves, if they ever want to kick a user off the service, they have a bunch of things they could point to saying the user's violated the terms of service. They may need it for privacy policy related issues. They may need it to limit liability in a lot of situations, but I don't think these are typically drafted thinking, oh, this is going to be used, you know, to federally indict one of our users later.
Right.
And so I think it's interesting how that plays out for businesses.
That's actually a great point because as long as social networking is free, there is, I mean, I cannot, you know, I've been, you know, involved with the internet for so many years and my brother, I just, no safeguard that could be possibly put in place that is foolproof. And there is no, I can't see any law that could be enacted that you could really prove someone's intent, you know, to in these types of services, you know, in these types of services, you know, the only way to really have any safeguards is to make them cost money, you know, and to and that way you retain some control over who your subscriber base is, and but of course that would be the death knell to these services.
Right, and
could you take a step back? Can you say the specific federal statute that the indictment is under and what the wording is that they're relying on?
I'd have to pull it up.
It's the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And
yeah.
I believe the wording, and I'm not quoting it directly, I'm just remembering off the top of my head, uses the terms unauthorized access. So the way that links in the terms of service is the MySpace terms require you to use your real name and also not to attempt to obtain information from a minor for the purpose of harassing them, something along those lines. So because the theory goes, the complaint goes, because Lori Drew violated the terms of service in those two ways, not only did MySpace then get the right to terminate her account or whatever other repercussions you would have from a terms of service violation, but she also was gaining unauthorized access. She was, you know, manipulating them, defrauding them, by masquerading as someone else and gaining access and thus triggering the criminal penalties of this statute. That's
she really was.
That's a little scary to me.
Who she really was gaining unauthorized access to is to Megan. It's because she would not have had access to talk to Megan under, you know, she created a false pretense in order to have this conversation. It's not really MySpace that she had unauthorized access to.
That's interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've heard tell there's something like a federal anti-cyberstalking statute. Is that not what this is?
Is there? I mean, is there a federal anti-cyberstalking statute?
I have absolutely heard, and I'll Google it while we're talking.
But I'm doing that. But you know what? Let me tell you something. Let me give you another perspective. From my personal perspective, this case doesn't have a chance in hell. Okay. And what you've done here is if Lori Drew was going to become a cause for legitimate legislation, all you've done here is hurt the cause by taking these, you know, just completely tenuous cases. You know, I mean, it's totally unfocused. I mean, if anything, this should have been a rallying cause to draft, you know, legitimate legislation, you know, address the cyberbullying, if it's in fact possible to craft an enforceable statute that's going to pass constitutional muster.
Yeah, that's
an interesting.
I feel
that it frankly hurts the cause.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and just sort of by comparison, I get calls probably once a week now from people who need to deal with defamation claims and defamation problems of posts by third parties on all of these open forums. And I get, you know, I'm very sympathetic and I'm trying to come up myself with like tools and ways that people can respond to that kind of stuff. But ultimately, there's very little you can do unless you want to bring a lawsuit under one of the state, typically a state claim, to stop the bullying. You can't go to the service provider because Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act usually will protect them if the service provider is savvy. And that's a good law. I like the law. I'm not criticizing that piece of the law, but it is unbelievable to me how many reputation-related problems are now coming to fruition. I mean, so much more than even a year ago, in my view, just in my own interactions.
I agree with you. And, you know, and I just think it's so all of a sudden now you have the attitude, hey, look at the Lori Drew case, the Fed's got it covered. And that's just not true. You know, instead of focusing on, you know, finding a real solution.
Yeah. One of the things that came out of the digital natives myth busting session at the Berkman Center's 10th anniversary recently was the notion that although sexual predators and legitimate stalkers get a lot of publicity and are of great concern to people when they consider the internet, that the thing that is much more prevalent is this kind of cyberbullying where, you know, it might not rise to the level of a threat or a crime, but it's certainly unpleasant. So I wanted to pick up on something Brian said a few minutes ago, and that is, you know, perhaps we need legislation to address that. What can you conceive of a way to address that problem?
You know, I think it's a big, I think it's going to be difficult because, you know, on one, you have the MySpaces and Facebooks of the world behind, you know, behind closed doors saying, that's great. You know, this is great. Yeah, we're all for it. You know, minors, this, that. But then you have the business people saying, that's going to totally, we might as well not even be in business. You know, if we have to come up with safeguards for that. So it's going to be very difficult because I think while you're going to have the token agreement that it's an important issue, you're not going to get any real cooperation in pushing forth the legislation.
Yeah. My personal opinion, I think, you know, as I sit here today, who knows, ask me tomorrow, I might say something else, is that this isn't really the realm for legislation. That, you know, sites need to set the tone for what happens there and enforce guidelines if they want to have a certain caliber of conversation. And if they don't do that, you know, you're going to have all hell break loose.
Well, I'm going to add one final thought on this for me is that, you know, people, for better or for worse, cyberbullying is bullying, you know, and if you get bullied in the schoolyard, you get bullied, you know, on cyberspace, you know, it's really not all that different, you know, and the responsibility starts at home, you know, not with Congress.
Yep. I agree with that.
You know, I agree with the concern about placing responsibility on the ISPs or MySpace. I think that, you know, they shouldn't be placed on the hook. They've got their terms and conditions. But let's back away from all this and just look at this like we're in a tribe. And somebody in the tribe has done something that sounds like, if the facts are as bad as they appear to be, so that's my assumption, number one, is that Lori Drew sat around and with her daughter and with some babysitter who's 18 years old who worked in her home and possibly some other people decided collaboratively to target this girl. And if she had prior conditions, and you know, in the civil world, we call it an eggshell plaintiff. But here, whatever it is, it's a person who's very sensitive and has insecurities, deep insecurities. That just makes it worse to me because she knew about it. So she's targeting this girl. This is reprehensible activity. If we're sitting around in a tribe and we don't have all these convoluted laws, at a minimum, we're going to do something like banish her from the tribe. Or, you know, just exclude her, because this is not socially useful behavior. It's quite the opposite. So we get bogged down in what law applies. I don't know what law applies, but if there's a law that applies and a prosecutor can find one that's close, I have no problem. Again, assuming all these facts are true, not that the prosecutors are on a vendetta, not that they're pursuing it because there's public outrage, but because it's the right thing to do when somebody does something this reprehensible. It's not a question of everyday bullying. It's a question of an adult who's 49 years old working with her daughter to torment this girl needlessly, if those facts are the way that they're described. And I suggest that we need some sort of proceeding, you know, court proceedings, whether they're civil or criminal, are great places to flush out exactly what happened. Maybe it's the case that Lori Drew didn't do anything that reprehensible. Great, let's have a trial and of some sort so we can find out for sure what happened. Because right now we're vetting this in the media, talking about all kinds of things. We don't really know what happened, and we're never going to know what happened. And this wound is going to fester and continue until we resolve it in some orderly way. And so I suggest that some sort of legal proceeding is actually a good idea here.
When you talk about the right thing to do, it becomes bigger than Lori Drew, okay? When you talk about federal prosecutors doing something only solely because it's the right thing to do, it becomes much bigger than Lori Drew. And that's real. I'm not saying there shouldn't be a special place somewhere for Lori Drew, but I'm saying it's bigger than her when you start just, again, doing things because it's the right thing to do. That always doesn't make it the legal thing to do or the proper way to do it. And that can be extrapolated out in so many ways and so many areas of law that I just, you know, well, there's prosecutorial discretion. It is not unbridled discretion.
Right. And you were pretty generous in your post on this, Brian, in saying that perhaps, you know, in their zeal to get an outrage indictment, these folks brought charges that perhaps they knew might not stick, but to make an example and to dissuade this kind of conduct from others. And you didn't mention that sometimes what happens in a high-profile case like this is the prosecutors see a chance to make a career and a name for themselves. That can definitely happen too. So
yeah, that's true. And, you know, and you don't hear about, you know, and it just sort of quietly skulks away if it doesn't work out, you know, unless the media just keeps it going, you know. But that's not justice, you know. That's media justice, you know. And media justice can kill a cause as much, just as quickly as it can help it.
Well, I wanted to, as long as we're on the topic of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and what constitutes a cyber crime or not, I wondered if you guys had taken a look at or heard about this whole thing that Revision 3 went through when it got hit with a denial of service attack over Memorial Day weekend. I don't know if you listened to this week's Twit, but they had Jim Lauterbach on and basically went through the whole scenario that this company, Media Defender, which is out there doing sort of, I don't know how to characterize them, stealth tactics, I guess would be a good way to put it, on behalf of copyright owners to try and basically break the BitTorrent system and seed false torrents and an attempt to, you know, frustrate people who are attempting to download copyrighted works in that way by mucking up the system. And Revision 3 wound up having, because they were distributing some of their shows via mm-hmm. BitTorrent, they had a BitTorrent server that they had accidentally left open. and it had pointers to a good deal of copyrighted material, and Media Defender came along and decided it was going to use that open server to carry out its sure. stealth tactics. And it wound up one way or another, you know, please, I am by no means any expert on how all of this technology unfolded. But one way or another, the Revision 3 site and services were quite adversely affected by this. And as Jim Lauterbach put it, you know, they didn't get any kind of advance notice or complaint or heads up that this was going to happen. Just all of a sudden, they were getting pummeled on their server, and it couldn't take the load and came down. What Mr. Lauterbach said was perhaps he didn't think he was going to file a lawsuit, but he had been in contact with the FBI, and there's some exchange there, and he was perhaps going to just send them over an invoice for the cost of having their shows not available for that length of time and their site down. What do you guys think about the ramifications of that and how this fits into something like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act?
Well, I'm familiar with this incident, and are not denial of service attacks, aren't there not statutes covering denial of service attacks, criminal statutes?
I believe there are.
Well, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Yeah.
Well, that
would be a good one.
There we go. I think
there are state statutes as well, and I can conceive of other doctrines that aren't statutory, such as the trespass to chattels doctrine, which basically...
I mean, and you can actually make a good analogy here for Lori Drew. Here we have denial of service attacks occur all the time. It's a crime. You know, and how many prosecutions do you see? You know, billions of dollars lost in worldwide revenue. And you don't see federal prosecutors going nuts over that. And, you know, and there are a lot of subscribers pretty outraged, you know, and business owners when they lose tons of revenue in these attacks.
I don't know if there's been many suits brought based on denial of service and the Computer Fraud
there
and Abuse Act.
There may be.
I'm very curious about that.
Well,
that's a media question. That's not our federal prosecutors prosecuting that. That's a question of if the media cares or whatever. But
don't you oftentimes wind up with defendants or would-be defendants, you know, in far-flung places where it's complicated to attempt to hail them into court, certainly in the U.S.?
Definitely. This one was interesting as Jim Lauterbach's blog post. I read the whole thing, Denise, because you had put it in the links, and I thought it was a great explanation of like both the what happened and then sort of the view and the costs and the impact it has on a company like theirs. And then I was curious myself, well, how many times has Media Defender been sued or their parent company, Artist Direct? I couldn't find any. I did a couple Pacer searches. I couldn't find Media Defender or the two principals he mentioned in the article listed as defendants anywhere, but I did find a couple suits with the parent, but they didn't seem related to anything, you know, related to copyright or these sort of criminal type things. So I would have thought there would have been some people suing them.
I think that ultimately there will be. if they continue the kind of conduct, you know, aimed at peer-to-peer networks and at BitTorrent, which can, you know, certainly be used for all kinds of legitimate uses, and more are being used so just to spread bandwidth and utilize network efficiencies.
I'd be really curious to know how many actual prosecutions there have been over the last, you know, years for these type of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
You know, because you just, you know, they just all seem, you know, you'll read about it, you know, somebody's investigating. You know, we've contacted the FBI, but they all, at least media-wise, they just all seem to fizzle into the night. You know, and maybe because that is that the perpetrators are so hard to, you know, are so gray that they're so hard to, you know, get a hold of. You know, but maybe, again, that's something that needs to be addressed, you know, by statute, you know, by Congress, you know, in the act, you know, or because is the alternative, we're just resigned to the monetary losses. You know, and no one's ever going to be prosecuted? Or are they just waiting for the one big one that they can get their hands on to make an example? I don't know.
Well, my impression is that there is, as the years unfold, more and more of this activity going on in a more organized way, not necessarily based in the U.S., but, you know, somewhere in Eastern European countries and perhaps tied to organized crime, of botnets that are out there organizing these sort of attacks, and where serious damage could be done, and there's just not that much to be done to stop them because of the way that it has spread out, that it's almost this gray, dark underbelly that no one can effectively poke at. And I don't know how that all unfolds and how it gets solved, but
I don't either. But I believe that anything can be poked if you actually sit down and figure out how to poke it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just right now, it just may not be, a priority, from a federal government standpoint, until some massive, sensitive data goes down and intact.
For what it's worth, I was Googling while all this is going on. A viewpoint. Here is the Center for Democracy and Technology, CDT.org. And this was obtained by using the term prosecution for denial of service as my search term. And this takes a very hands-off approach. One of the subject headings is, the government has a limited role and should focus on getting its own house in order before doing this sort of thing. And it says that the ability to defend against denial of service is best undertaken by the private sector, that the ways of preventing and defending against denial of service has been widely disseminated by the IETF. And rather than having a government prosecute this sort of thing, private industry should be protecting themselves. So there's that viewpoint.
Right.
That is certainly the cost-effective viewpoint.
And it's one that doesn't really take into account individuals as well and the way they can be both used in these schemes and victimized by them. But it's pretty interesting, under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the threshold damages you need to have suffered are $5,000 in order to take action. So I think Revision 3 would, given their amount of traffic and their popularity of shows, I think they would meet the threshold.
Yeah, and you know what? I think just about any company big enough to have the privilege of being subject to these attacks probably is going to meet that threshold.
So
those numbers are not hard to come to.
So one thing that has been percolating out in the news lately that I'm frankly still kind of flummoxed by and haven't arrived at an opinion yet for myself is the pending Orphan Works legislation. There seems to be a lot of controversy about whether the act that is pending is a good one. Someone, on the one hand, we have EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, saying it's a good thing, and that we need some mechanism to allow people to use Orphan Works without fearing the rather steep and onerous damages that copyright infringement can entail. And on the other hand, you have one of the, at least our country's great copyright reform advocates, Larry Lessig, saying that, yes, while all that is true, this act is not the way to go about it. Have you guys taken a look at this? And is anyone...
Looking at it right now.
Has anyone formed a solid opinion one way or another about the merits of this pending legislation? What do you think, Colette?
Thanks, Denise. I haven't looked at it in super deep detail, but I do... I think that the legislation, my understanding of just reading kind of what's out there in the blogs, is that it's a little simplistic in solving the problem. And because of that, it's going to get a lot of – it's probably unlikely to pass. I think there's going to be enough problems with it that it won't pass. Whether it creates the debate that we need to have, though, is, I think, an important question. I mean, my problem with all of the copyright legislation in the last, 10 years or attempts to change it is I think Congress is busy with a bunch of other things. They're fighting, we're in a war, we're doing, we have an election, we have all these other issues. It's hard to say, have Congress focus on this particular issue or other aspects of copyright reform, things having to do with fair use. And it's unfortunate, but hopefully by having these bills percolating, there will be more of a discussion about what to do with this problem, because there is so much content that's sort of locked up in copyright that nobody, even the copyright owners themselves, if they even knew they owned it, would not intend for these works to be not available and not used. But sorry, I can't be more specific right at this second, but that's sort of my initial feeling.
Well, the two primary complaints that I've heard about this proposed legislation are that it places a burden on rights holders that wouldn't otherwise exist under the Copyright Act as we know it, and that is the burden of actually registering their works in some way or another in order to prevent them from becoming an orphan work that then could be used. And the other complaint that I've heard is that on the other side of the equation, from the standpoint of folks who want to use orphan works, the work that they will have to do or commission to have done to search for and ensure that the work that they seek to use is not subject to copyright is you know, undefined and too great a burden, and that it would result in lining the pockets or creating a whole new industry of folks who can go out and do this sort of search for you. You know, as we know in the trademark world, Marty, that's not necessarily something to be afraid of, if the legislation otherwise functions.
Well, I mean, we impose a burden upon copyright owners that they have to register their copyright in order to have standing to go into civil court. So it's not the most hard to meet, most unreasonable burden that I've ever heard of, when contrasted against what's going on, which is that a huge amount of our culture is locked up now in this uncertain status. So I'm don't play my violin in sympathy for the thought that copyright owners would have to actually do some affirmative act to protect the work and then make another affirmative act perhaps 50 years later.
What do you think about this notion that the protections that this act is supposed to afford to people who want to use orphan works are somewhat undercut by the fact that, you know, there's not a whole lot of clarity going into it as to what they'll have to do to assure that the work that they're using is not under copyright?
Are we talking about the specifics of this proposed legislation?
Yeah, which is fairly vague as to, you know, you have to do some sort of sufficient search.
I will cynically state that in 20 years of commenting on proposed legislation, none of that time was well spent, because the draft is always in a certain phase for public comments, and then the lobbyists get to it 24 hours before.
Right.
So commenting on specific rights and remedies in legislation is just not not time well spent. I just, you know, really rather discuss the policy about that. We really need to have some form of notice sometime into the term. We departed from the renewal model, you know, with the 79 Act, and there were reasons for it. But the idea of some sort of low-level form of notice doesn't seem like such a – it sounds like a good start. And then as to what you want to do from then, look, it's going to be a battle between the lobbyists. So I'm just in the bleacher seats.
Yeah, the other thing that strikes me in response to that complaint about the statute is that every statute has vagaries about it, and oftentimes purposely so that the courts can iron out what is appropriate in each circumstance. You know, if we had to make each statute address every specific possible scenario, number one, they wouldn't function properly. Number two, they'd never get enacted. So, you know, I don't necessarily see that as a reason to reject this out of hand.
I thought that was the way the legislation actually worked, is that they loaded everything in there and overlarded it.
Right. I just watched the HBO special Recount last night. So if you doubts about the means of statutory interpretation and susceptibility to many different meanings, then that's a good one to watch.
And it's always a great joy to go back and hear about hanging chads and so forth.
Yeah.
I want to say one thing about this. You all were talking about, or you, Denise, were saying that one of the problems with this orphan works is the idea that it goes too far, because it requires something additional of copyright holders. And I know Larry Lessig voiced the same concern, but his concern was that it would do this immediately. It seems to me And I agree with Marty. I think it's a low threshold to retain your rights by merely filing something. I think the problem is maybe people don't know that, just like some people, I don't know where they are, but who don't know that they're going to lose their, you know, TV signal if they don't switch to digital soon. You know, we just need to notify people that that's the case and give them time. But what's the big burden once they know that they're supposed to do that? If it's official.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Ernie. So there's this international requirement, if we want to be part of the Berne Convention, to not require formalities such as registration in order for protection of copyright. And I think that's one reason why in 1976 we took that requirement out. So if you give people their copyright immediately upon fixation, which is the test now, and then only require something formal for a renewal or an extension or a continuation of your full term, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think that hopefully that would comply with the requirements in the international treaties that we're members of. It seems like that kind of a burden is very low, because the only people who, in theory, the people who want to monetize and continue to reap some sort of licensing or financial benefit out of their copyright will be focused on that and will take the time to achieve that minimum hurdle, which is submitting a piece of paper to the copyright office and a very low fee. I don't know. At one point, they were bouncing around $1, but it could be, you know, even more than that and still seem to me be worth it. So I think that's, I don't know. I come out sort of the same way, I think, as you on that.
I put a couple of links in the show notes to two posts by Jonathan Bailey, who writes Plagiarism Today, who also seems to be very close to indecision on this issue, although he comes down on the side of this is not the legislation to accomplish what we need. But even so, he writes some compelling counterpoints to that position and points out that the way this would come up is as an affirmative defense. You come along, you see that there's an infringement happening of your work, you sue, and the person gets to raise it as an affirmative defense. And basically what it does is shield them from, you know, the astronomical damages that currently exist. So, you know, given that they're not losing the right to sue or recover damages or prevent the infringement, there simply would be, you know, a cap on what's currently statutorily available. That's a fairly persuasive point, I think, that, you know, maybe it's not the ideal solution, but it's certainly addressing something that is a big policy problem. And, you know, if it doesn't work out perfectly, there's always the opportunity to tinker with it down the road.
I think in a lot of ways it depends what the wishy-washy standards are that we were talking about a moment ago. You know, as a copyright lawyer, you can always litigate it. You can always look for the facts and try and come up with a strategy to defend. And just like on a fair use defense, it's sort of an unappealing situation, because if you're the creator who wants to use this work and you can't find the copyright owner and it doesn't look like you know there's no way to get the clearance that you need, but depending on what the how specific the factors are that allow you to go forward and have your affirmative defense, it's sort of cold comfort, I guess, for someone who wants to, work from the existing culture that's out there and copyrighted materials that are in that culture. I see it a little bit as the same problem we have with fair use. You want the statute to be broad enough and to allow for it to develop over time and not be too restrictive, but then you also want to give people clarity so that they can move forward with either business or personal endeavors that involve these works.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, you certainly would not want it for all the problems that fair use, you know, can entangle you in because of its uncertainties. It's nice that it's there. and I think
exactly.
I think that, you know, ultimately that's probably where I come down on this proposed orphan works piece of law. We'll see what happens with it. Speaking of copyright reform, that seems to be what Google is after in their responding finally to the complaint that has been pending against them for so long by Viacom in its billion-dollar lawsuit. I have not been following that case procedurally at all since it was filed, but there must have been attacks on the initial complaint. How is it? Has anyone any idea how is it that we're just now seeing the response to the complaint filed?
Well, this is the answer to the.
Go ahead, Marie.
This is the answer to the amended complaint.
The amended complaint. So
right, they filed an answer to the first complaint.
Okay. So, news flash for anybody who didn't already know this: litigation takes a really long time, longer than you can even imagine. Brian, what were you saying?
No, I was just responding to say I had not been following that litigation.
Yeah, so we do have Google's response on file, and although it contains the standard specific denials of everything in the complaint, which you have to do under law in federal court, it does contain some interesting language of sort of setting up their position in the case that if one were to accept Viacom's allegations as gospel and that the safe harbor functions as Viacom characterizes it rather than as Google does, then you're quelling a whole bunch of ability to communicate and speak and entertain. And so it looks like this one is set up to go for a while. Does anyone have any thoughts on the case or on the response to the complaint?
I would say, I mean, this case is going exactly as I would have anticipated from the very beginning. I remember when it was filed, and I still firmly believe there will be a settlement at some point, not, you know, maybe closer to trial, but there will be a settlement. This is nothing that either side, I think, wants to have federal court ruling on, and that will be appealed and whatnot, because there's just too many things at risk for each company or each, you know, the plaintiffs, which are several companies, and then the Google side. I'm glad part of me is glad that these are the parties fighting it out, because I think that they both have teams of lawyers that will, you know, unturn every possible stone. It won't be something that'll get fought out in a pro se action or something else. I really think that this is, even just looking at the answer that Google and YouTube just filed, you know, they have a long introduction to kind of explain the policy and the theory behind why their position is what it is. So I think they have to do that partly for press, but they also are trying to signal to the plaintiffs, you know, that they're on, this case is just something that's not a clear cut. I mean, they're not. I'm sure Google and YouTube think it's clear cut, but I don't think anyone else does.
Marty, since you're in their jurisdiction where this is pending, do you have any thoughts on the Southern District of New York or the Second Circuit and how they are inclined to view the assertions that Google has made and appears ready to pursue?
Well, I'll sound a little chauvinistic and say I'm glad that it's in our circuit. I mean, the judges are experienced. At the Second Circuit, we've got Judge LaValle, who's just a preeminent thinker on copyright. So I guess that's the best news. I don't think that, I'll just say we'll get an intelligent, thought out hearing of these grievances. I have the answer in front of me. It's just sort of kind of interesting. Speaking to Colette's point about thoroughness of the lawyering, these are the defenses. First defense is the DMCA safe harbor. Second defense is license. I thought that was an interesting choice. Plaintiff claims are barred in whole or in part by licenses expressed and implied, granted by plaintiffs. Then there's fair use, failure to mitigate, failure to state a claim, innocent intent, copyright misuse, and then, you know, the usual boilerplate estoppel waiver, unclean hands and latches. So we should... If this gets litigated, it should be entertaining and educational.
Yeah, I will love to see how that license one plays out.
Yeah.
And this case is pending in front of Lewis Stanton. You know anything about him, Artie?
He's okay. I'll leave it at that. I'm careful not to say bad things about Southern District judges.
a wise thing.
Well, I have a small nit to pick. This is a procedural point. The as we know about federal pleading requirements, you're supposed to simply provide a short, concise statement of the facts and the relevant law. It's really interesting that complaints, and this is a classic example, the beginning of them now read like press statements. Like there's an expansive, harumphing. And, for example, in this one, it says, looking at the online world today, there is no question that Congress made the correct policy choice. What is this? What is this preamble? People put this kind of stuff in complaints because they know that filing these things is now more about getting specific judicial relief or it's partly about that, but it's also about pandering to the press.
Well, you know who you need to blame? Pacer, Justia, and me.
I would never blame you, Marty.
No. I'm part of the problem because we conspire to make pleadings readily accessible to the world now. So prior to Pacer, it was pretty difficult to get your hands on the actual pleadings that were involved in newsworthy cases. If you were lucky, you could get the party's lawyers on the phone and get them to fax you a 60-page document. Now, thanks to ECF, and then Pacer, the electronic form is accessible on the internet, usually within about 48 hours of filing. Then you take someone like Justia, who makes a user-friendly, search tool on top of Pacer. And then you have people like me who are using technology like iPaper to embed the pleadings on a blog. So only people with a real vested interest in the case could really get their hands on actual pleadings 3 or 4 years ago. And now we conspire to make it readily accessible to everyone. And given that they're only going to read the first page or two, that creates a motivation, one more way for the party to get their message out. So in a way, how can you blame them for putting advocacy statements in what you correctly point out is a short, statement of claim and of your defenses?
I don't blame you, Marty. I blame O.J. Simpson.
I always wonder, actually, sometimes in cases I've handled, whether I'm plaintiff or defendant, the other side will put this lengthy thing, sometimes it's pages, and I am tempted to move to strike it because it's not responsive to the thing. Like, if I'm the plaintiff, it's not responsive to the complaint, but it's obviously... It's like, how is it annoying, or is it something that really harms your client to have the other side's like lengthy press statement in the front of a complaint? I'm really curious of how receptive judges would be to those kinds of motions. Probably like, this is a waste of our time. I don't know.
I've certainly seen those kinds of motions brought and granted. So, it's not unheard of. And what I think is really interesting about Marty's point is that, yes, the legal process does become more and more transparent through technology and people using it. And, another upshot is that these arcane legal niceties, such as the specific denial of every allegation in a federal legal complaint, just become ludicrous and ridiculous when exposed to public view. Folks just look at that and go, what are you doing? Why are you spending 90 pages doing this? Why are you wasting my time? So I do think it has an interesting impact, and who knows, down the road may change the way. Maybe we'll see more answers to complaints that are substantive as opposed to simply technical as they've been in the past. The law, of course, would need to change for that to happen.
Yeah, or just practice, I don't think the federal rules require, they do require specific response, either an admission or denial or, lacking information and belief. But I don't know. It's an interesting question. As the law gets more transparent, or what lawyers do is so available on the internet, it will be interesting in how it affects the way people practice and how they draft complaints and answers and all these technical things.
Well, this is the justification for why, for example, the Supreme Court says that they don't want to allow cameras in the courtroom. And I think cameras in the courtroom are inevitable. They're going to happen one day. But the reason why judges currently don't like it is, and I was just only partly joking about the O.J. Simpson matter, is the O.J. Simpson case. That was the shining example of media circus out of control. And I don't blame O.J. Simpson. I blame Judge Ito, because the reigning force here is the judge. The judge, you know, a judge should prevent attorneys from engaging in this sort of behavior. That's what's going to be required once we have cameras in the courtroom. There's going to be chaos unless judges impose discipline, because if you don't impose discipline, lawyers will take advantage of whatever opportunity they have. And this is what they perceive to be an opportunity, and they will take advantage of it unless they're told that they can't, which they should be told not to.
Well, that's a really good segue, actually, into our usual Audible sponsorship plug here, which I'm going to inject at this point. Because even if you couldn't have been in the courtroom to hear the Bush versus Gore decision in the U.S. Supreme Court, that is the one of the driving acts in the movie Recount that I mentioned before, you can hear it read to you on Audible. Not necessarily the hearing. I didn't see that there, although one of the Florida Supreme Court hearings is also there. But the entire Supreme Court decision on the Florida Recount is available on audible.com. who we're very happy to have as a sponsor of the TWiT Network and of This Week in Law. And it is 2 hours and 20 minutes long. So if you want to go through what the lawyers in the Bush versus Gore case had to go through when they initially got that decision and had to figure out who won and who lost, this would be a great way to do it, to have it read by Audible. And if you go to audible.com/twit, you can actually register if you don't already have an Audible account and pick that up or any of their other 40,000 plus selections for free. So I encourage you to do that. There's so much good stuff on Audible. Every single week, I'm finding something new and great there to listen to as I run around town and as I entertain my son with their new Audible Kids huge site that has great stuff for kids. I'm so glad it's there, and I'm so glad they are with us supporting the show. So thanks very much, Audible. And thanks very much to all of you for joining us today. It's been a really fun discussion and some stuff that is kind of dense and kind of important. So I'm glad that all of our panelists were able to take the time and break from their busy schedules and join us here today on TWiL. Brian, you especially, welcome to the show, and hope to have you back sometime.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Sure. And good luck with all of your endeavors, and we'll keep up with you online at the Cuban Revolution.
Thanks. You all take care. It was a pleasure.
Okay. Colette, great to have you back again. And do you have anything coming up that you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm going to be talking in September. I guess it's still a few months out. About the whole reputation problem that we mentioned earlier, kind of relating to the topic we opened the conversation with. There's a panel at a Pike and Fisher conference in D.C. that's going to be dealing with Section 230 and then also reputation issues. And the representative from the company Reputation Defender and Mark Britton from Avvo and me and I think one or two other people, we're going to be trying to hack this problem about reputation and ratings and then, in my view, privacy, because there's got to be some kind of solution. And between now and then, I hope to really kind of get my head around what the options are for individuals, mostly, who have been harmed. So I'm kind of focused on that this summer.
Oh, that's going to be really interesting. Where is it again?
It's in D.C., and if you'd like, I'll send you a link if you want to put that in the show notes. I'm sorry I don't have it. It's not even on my on my site yet. I haven't posted it because it just kind of came together last month. So yeah, it's Pike and Fisher is the sponsor of the conference. It's a 2-day, I think it's September 16th and 17th.
So. Yeah, it's funny. As much time as we spent talking about copyright today, I think that whole area of reputation in Section 230 is becoming even more important in the way that law impacts the internet. So I'm glad you guys are going to take a hard look at that.
Yeah, I think it'll be challenging, but it'll be fun. So thanks. That's what I'm up to.
Cool. Marty, I saw that you recently opened up comments on the trademark blog. Woohoo! Very exciting.
For about 6 years, I took the glib view that it was hard enough disseminating correct information. Why would I take on the burden of disseminating incorrect information? But then someone talked me into using the Discuss product, which will allow me, you know, to rapidly see comments as they came in. So I figured I'll take a flyer.
Right. And
so please comment.
Since
Google
you're all
the trademark blog, find something that I say, that is provocatively wrong and put in a comment to set me straight.
And since Section 230 will protect you in most instances, you're probably in good shape. But I did see your three sentence or two sentence disclaimer or terms of service, which was also great.
Well, we'll look forward to commenting on that, on your stuff. Denise, I did get the name of that conference, if you'd like it. It's called Overcoming Legal Hurdles in the Web 2.0 World.
Nice. So they're going to.
So it's obviously not just reputation. There's all sorts of other issues.
Yeah, they're going to cover lots of stuff. And there's a link you can send me so I can stick it in the show notes.
Yes, I will do that.
Wonderful. Ernie, what are you up to these days?
Oh, I'm just, you know, participating in the recovery of New Orleans, searching for truth and justice. And, you know, that's pretty much it.
That's good. Worthy tasks.
No, just practicing law, you know, doing my thing.
Good. Did you go to Jazz Fest this year?
I did. I didn't go see any of the big name acts. I'm really sorry that I didn't get to see like Alison Krauss and Robert Plant and Sheryl Crow. But it's just I'm not somebody who enjoys fighting large crowds just to be part of a mass populace. So I didn't go see that. But there were lots of great smaller little things, like the Gospel Tent is always really great. In fact, if I could figure out where the Gospel Tent moves to on Sundays, I would probably go to church every day just to hear the music. So that was a big thrill.
Cool. Well, we will, as always, keep reading you on ErnieTheAttorney.net. And you're also Ernie Attorney or Ernie the Attorney on Twitter?
I think it's Ernie Attorney on Twitter, but I've not been using Twitter. I'm kind of like, soured on the Twitter thing, so I'm not Twittering much. I mean, it's just there's too many outputs. You know, I have enough trouble just speaking clearly without figuring out all the other writing channels and so forth. So,
right.
Kind of not doing so much on the Twitter thing.
Marty, you're on Twitter, aren't you?
Absolutely. For the time being.
Are you M. Schwimmer?
M. Schwimmer, follow me on Twitter for some reason.
Yeah. And how about you, Colette?
I have an account. Occasionally I go to it. Like when I'm at a conference, I find it to be a good way to know where people are and where what's going on. But I'm definitely in Ernie's camp. There's just too many outputs and inputs. And I just can't keep up with everything. So I kind of choose to be quiet on Twitter.
I didn't get the chance to ask Brian, but I think he's on there. If he is, I'll link to that in the show notes as well. I kind of am loving Twitter.
I think it is a love fest, and then I hate to say hate fest, but yeah. That's how I feel. Both I go back and forth.
Yeah, I love having it. Sort of takes search and makes it very human and instant. If you need to get a response back on something. And
when I was at South by Southwest, a friend of mine showed me a thing for my iPhone that gives me the Twitter in a way that I could actually kind of just follow it better. I don't know. I used to have a different cell phone and it just was annoying because I was like, just didn't work well for me. But on the iPhone, it was pretty nice.
What were you using?
When I need it. I have to look at the phone to find the program. You know what? I think I took it off. So.
Yeah, there are a lot of Twitter clients for the iPhone. I use something called Pocket Tweets, which I like.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Is there one called iTweet?
I think so, yeah.
I think it might have been iTweet, actually. But, yeah, I don't know.
It is kind of an amazing thing to watch unfold. They have so many technical hurdles that they're trying to overcome seemingly daily. Last weekend, they seemed to have gotten everything working so well that everything was coming to me in just fire hose fashion, which was both wonderful and overwhelming at the same time. So it's
exactly.
It's almost a relief when they have an outage, but I miss it too at the same time. So,
well, you guys stay on Twitter because I'm definitely happy that my friends are on. Because, for example, unless Marty had a Twitter account that he was shopping for deer resistant hardy perennials.
I did, in fact, come to think of it.
And did you find them?
We did. Nettles.
There you go.
Wow.
See, eternally useful, Twitter. Anyway, folks, it's been a pleasure getting you all back together, and we'll do it again very soon.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much, and that's it for This Week in Law.
Wait, we forgot
about
Prince and Radiohead.
Prince and Radiohead. Talk about Prince and Radiohead before we sign off.
Listen, you guys,
go ahead and
you guys
Twitter
like
it, Marty.
What?
Twitter it.
I would just give a tiny URL for this, but I want to know what you guys think, because you guys like a good DMCA puzzler.
Yeah.
You know the song Creep by Radiohead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Great song. Prince did a cover at a concert. Somebody filmed it and uploaded it to YouTube.
Freudian slip there.
Prince got it taken down using a DMCA complaint.
Uh-huh.
Radiohead found out about it and said, you can't do that. That's our song. And besides, we wanted to see you do our song. We wanted to see how we're curious. And now we don't have any way of knowing that.
Oh, that's great.
Fascinating.
Prince doesn't...
When you do a cover of someone else's song, though, don't you get your own independent copyright in the cover?
When you make a sound recording a cover, you have a copyright in your sound recording.
Exactly.
But
Prince didn't make this particular sound recording.
You see, he didn't. The particular video didn't infringe. If he had recorded that, this video wouldn't be a copy of Prince's recording.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's its own independent copy.
This is a law school exam.
Yeah, there is like an anti-bootlegging statute.
Right.
Right.
So,
I think it's a criminal statute, though. It's not a civil.
Well, I mean, the video could be in trouble for various reasons, right? Publicity. It could possibly be a breach of contract if admittance to the concert prevented you from filming.
Cyberbullying.
But do you have, you know, the right to utilize DMCA? Because that's the copyright owner.
Right.
Maybe,
DMCA for that.
You could, I mean, he could very well have a good faith belief that he owns a copyright. So, for example, if there's choreography and he filmed, and I think there was a report that his own people filmed his performance. So that could be the fixation.
Okay.
And it infringed, like, his choreography. His set could be copyrightable. So Prince could certainly have a good faith belief that he owns some form of copyright.
And this from a guy who changed his name to the artist formerly known as Prince because of there was some sort of copyright implications there as well, right?
It was a contract.
There was an alleged IP explanation.
See, this case could be like the O.J. case, which I have long contended. You know, if you just follow O.J. Simpson's legal problems, you could teach an entire law school curriculum. You know, it has everything. And this would be the subset. This would be like IP law. You could just follow Prince because everything involving all the cutting-edge issues in IP law and contract problems with IP stuff would be present in the Prince case. So let's get to work on starting that law school.
Absolutely be a good copyright law school exam.
All right.
And it involves a pretty good song.
So all you law profs out there listening, make us proud. Send us your exam questions.
Okay.
That's great.
All right. Thank you, Marty.
All right.
I'll try and find a link to that for folks if they want to read more. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you next time.